I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to an ideas show from the Blue Metropolis Festival in Montreal. We're calling this episode, The Author as Fiction. Every year, one of the great perks of my job involves a brief visit to Montreal and the Blue Metropolis Métropole Bleue Literary Festival. It's always springtime, and I get to read books, usually fiction, that I wouldn't normally have an opportunity to read. This year it was my pleasure and privilege to meet a fascinating Dutch author named Arnon Grunberg. I'm calling this episode The Author as Fiction because, as you'll hear, Mr. Grunberg's first book was a somewhat swashbuckling account of his own young life as a high school dropout and wannabe gigolo in the red light district of his hometown, Amsterdam. It was called Blue Mondays, and it won the prize for the best first novel published in Holland in 1994. 6 years later, writing under the pseudonym Mark van der Jacht, he once again won the same prize. Arnon Grunberg has consistently lived that kind of fantastic, almost fictional life. When we met, on stage at the Blue Metropolis, we started talking about his most recent book to be published in English, a novel called Tirza. I read this book, believe it or not, in Amsterdam. I was there for one glorious night. I booked early to come back to Canada. Had a seat, went to the airport at Schiphol, and I got my boarding pass printed, and it said standby. And I went to the desk and said, no, not standby, I'm in seat 42K, and I shouldn't be here, standby. And she said, oh, it's our problem, KLM has overbooked the flight, and just go to the gate, you'll probably get on. Well, I went to the gate, and they called the flight, and all but nine people got on that flight. I was one of the nine, and it was great. KLM, much better than Air Canada, I would say, gave me 600 euros and a hotel room, and I had an extra night in Holland, so I read your book. Is that a good place to read your book?
I guess so, especially when you earn 600 euros for staying there. Yeah,
that's true. I was paid to read this book.
I think it's a good deal.
Yeah. Not bad.
No, but on a more serious note, no, I think you can read the book anywhere. There's no special place. Also, sometimes I get a question that if I imagine my readers somewhere, and to be honest, I don't. And once I was on a train in the Netherlands, and I saw somebody reading my book. It made me so uncomfortable that I moved to another compartment.
Why uncomfortable?
It's something you don't want to see as an author.
Because you don't want to see someone
yawning.
Reading your book.
I had a feeling it was a woman. She was about to give up on my book, or that was at least maybe it was my fear. But I had a feeling that she was not really into it. So I thought, no, I'm not going to witness this further. And I didn't say a word. I'm not sure if she recognized me, but I just moved away.
What you just said might make me want to try to read in private from now on, just in case the author was present.
Well,
or to be very careful when I'm reading it.
Well, of course, the good thing about the e-book is that you cannot see anymore what a person is reading.
Ah.
At least that's one of the advantages. I'm also a curious person, so often I'd like to see what somebody is reading, and the disadvantage of the e-book is that you can't see it unless you really make an effort. But when it's about your own book, it can come in handy.
I wonder if that's common with all writers. They don't like to see their books being read. I would have thought it would be highly flattering.
Of course, it's in a way it's flattering, but it's not something... It's very private. I think the act of reading is a very private act, and... It's the same. I would sometimes on a plane, somebody is really reading what I'm reading, whether it's a newspaper and I can imagine, but still it's a bit disturbing. I want to, it's between me and the book. I don't want somebody else over my shoulder looking what I'm reading. No. Can you understand this feeling?
I understand it. And I'm reading is a very important thing, obviously, for writers, because you write to be read.
Absolutely.
And so you want readers, but you maybe don't want to be part of the process of them reading your book, them reinterpreting your book, them imagining the world that you wrote.
Well, of course, I mean, like on events like these, then there's an interaction between the reader and author, and that's nice. But when the reader is not aware that the author is sitting next to this person, it feels a bit uncomfortable. That was all that was all what I was saying.
Okay.
Nothing more.
I'm not trying to psychoanalyze either. Basically, the structure of this interview I have is written on this one piece of paper.
And this all?
That's it.
You have no more questions?
Well, there's only two questions, actually.
Then.
But there will be sub-questions, of course, after that. And I just have the feeling you and I can talk as we started at the back of the room. The first question, where were you on September 11th, 2001?
I was in New York. I moved to New York in 1995, January 15th. I was 24, and I was in love with a psychologist who was born in Yonkers. I met her in Amsterdam. She was raised in Amsterdam, in Hilversum, a city in the Netherlands, and she wanted to work as a psychologist in New York City because in her imagination, she has dual citizenship, that all the crazies, all the really mad people would be there.
And really?
You know the feeling of being in love with somebody. So I thought, I just said, okay, I'll follow you without knowing anything about it. I'd never been to the States. Some people really dream about of going to New York, and it was never something I wanted to accomplish. But I just said, okay, I'll go with you. And that's how I moved to New York. And then after a while, I discovered that New York is a really good city to live in, and I didn't want to go back to Amsterdam. And even when the relationship ended, I decided to stay in New York.
So 1995 to 2001.
In 2001, I was in Manhattan. 2001, I was in Manhattan. It happened, as you know, in the morning. I was having coffee at a cafe where at that time I went every morning, Dolce on Park, and I was having a cup of coffee there and eating a croissant or something.
Dolce on Park is where?
I live on 37 between Park and Madison and Dolce on Park. Now it's a Korean tea room, but back then it was an Italian restaurant and a coffee shop. It's Park Avenue between 34th and 35th.
So it's Midtown. You're not down.
No,
right
no, don't
next
call it Midtown. Midtown is north of.
I'm talking to a New Yorker.
No, but Midtown is really well. I don't like Midtown too much. It's called Murray Hill. Midtown is north
Murray
of
Hill.
Murray Hill. Yes.
It could be Upper Village or something almost. If you
Midtown is more like offices and it's a bit dreadful. Right. I would say.
So, and you saw the towers go down, or?
No, I saw smoke after a while. And first the waiter said, oh, this is like a small plane that went into the towers. And then I went home, and I had a deadline, so I started working on my piece.
Wow.
And then, of course, I had at that time a fiancée, an old lady with whom I didn't have, she was 78 years old, and to make things clear, I didn't have a sexual relationship with her. But I met her at this coffee shop, and she liked practical jokes very much. I met her in 2000, and we became friends. And then she said, my big love was a man from Lebanon, and I never managed to get married to him. And I'd like to throw a party in order to be engaged, an engagement party. Couldn't we be engaged? That's all I had. I said, of course we can. Why not? So we had this big engagement party, and it was really fun. And
Where's the deadline?
What did you say?
I'm an editor here.
Yes, the deadline?
Yeah, where's the deadline?
Oh, the deadline of the that's what I wrote my piece, and then this fiancé called me.
Okay.
Well, excuse me, this fiancé called me, and thank you for reminding me of this. called me and said, do you want to see me, or can we see each other? So I spent the rest of the day with her, and we went, I spent the rest of the day with her.
Now, the reason for the question was that in one of the reviews that I read of Tirzah, it described this as one of the best examples thus far of a post 9/11 novel. And I wanted to know how you felt about that.
I did write a piece about 9/11. I was at that time, I started writing columns for a Dutch newspaper shortly after moving to New York. And the piece I wrote about my experiences on 9/11 made many people angry. I never got as many angry letters as I did get about that piece.
What did you say in the piece that made
nothing?
People
I just
angry.
Described what was going on in my neighborhood, and the jokes people were also making. I mean, for example, many people couldn't leave, so I was sitting that evening in a hotel next to my apartment with a group of businessmen who had ordered a pizza together because they were supposed to fly out that afternoon, but of course there were no planes, and they were just cracking jokes, and I was describing what was happening and what people said to each other. And I guess for the people in Amsterdam or in the Netherlands who had seen all the events just on television and repetition of these events all day long, they couldn't imagine that this was going on just 2 miles north of the Twin Towers. So they found it very disrespectful. Whereas I just wanted to be journalistic and realistic what was happening not far from that, from ground zero. Hmm.
What do you think the critic was saying when he described this as a post-9/11 novel?
Well, I guess it's hard to get into the mind of a critic, but I guess he was referring to the fact that, that there's a character that's not Mohammed Atta, but that's in the mind of the main character of the novel, Jürgen Hofmeister, who's really, the novel is called Tirza, but Tirza's the daughter of this man. And the boyfriend of Tirza, a Moroccan man living in the Netherlands, he meets this man at a party and he thinks this man reminds me of somebody, I've seen him before. And then he thinks, oh, this is Mohammed Atta. This is one of those, it's not exactly Mohammed Atta, but it is one of those men. It's another Mohammed Atta.
That's a specific connection for sure. And I hadn't even thought of that. This is how my mind works, I guess. I thought it was the major character, Hofmeister, who was a post-9/11 character. I mean, he's facing experiences in his life. He's 50-something years old. I don't know if you specify the age, but he's in this bizarre situation where his wife left him 3 years earlier and she arrives on his doorstep at a critical moment when he's preparing a graduation party for his daughter, Tirza. And his life, he's lost his job or he's losing his job. I mean, he's in a post-9/11 situation, I guess. And I thought it was sort of the headspace. And also he's being challenged. I mean, he's lived a regulated J. Alfred Prufrock kind of life, measuring out his life in teaspoons. And now he's living in complete chaos. And that somehow that was a metaphor for the way the world works after the Twin Towers.
Could be, but the chaos he is in started before 9/11, I would say. Mm. He lost his money. They couldn't fire him. The publishing company is an editor at a publishing house. They couldn't fire him because he's too old to get fired. So something happens to him that may be even more devastating. The manager tells him, we give you money, but please don't show up anymore. We'll pay you till you're 65, but don't come into the office anymore. And he's so ashamed of this rejection, he feels it's a rejection, that he pretends that he's still going to work, but in reality he's going to the airport to spend the day at Amsterdam Airport. There the airport is back. Yeah. And he's just waving at passengers in order not to attract too much attention. So the more connection, of course, than only Mohammed Atta and 9/11. But I would say the state of mind he is in is not only caused by 9/11. 9/11 is just a very convenient event for him to blame it all on right. What's happening this day.
And what he's going through is a classic midlife crisis where everything is falling apart around him.
In his case, it is not only the midlife.
It started when he was born.
Exactly.
Yeah, he is a sort of sad character. I don't think he considers himself sad, but when I read him, I'm thinking, oh, the poor, you know, his wife arrives at the front door after 3 years away, and he's putting a casserole into the oven, and he has more trouble with the fact that he's got to pull the casserole out than he's got to deal with his relationship.
But of course, it's what would you do when your wife would come in after 3 years, or what would I do when my girlfriend would show up suddenly after you waited for her to come back so long, and suddenly she's there? I think I would focus also, not that I'm the same as Hofmeister.
Right. Hope not.
But I think I would focus, it's very human to focus on something practical you're doing, because sometimes there's so many occasions you just don't know how to react.
Yeah. Yeah,
also it's a matter of being conscious about yourself. I think one of the things what makes this character for me appealing is that he's one of those men who's constantly conscious about what he's doing. So he does a thing and then he feels, he's a man, I think being ashamed is very a good description to describe his state of mind. He's constantly on the verge of being ashamed.
Which is close to hell for him.
Of course, it's close to hell. If you're always ashamed all the time, I mean, we are ashamed maybe once a day or twice a day, but
it's exacerbated by the fact that he identifies as prideful things like his address. You know, like he tells people where he lives, and they go, oh, and suddenly he's pegged up on the upper edge of the scale somewhere and given approval rather than shame.
Yeah, that was one of the things I discovered in New York. Nobody ever asked me what I was doing, but they always asked me, where do you live? And then I found out that the zip code was quite important. Hmm. It says, and also, of course, in Amsterdam, this part of Amsterdam, I used to live for a while also in that part. That's really like a posh part. That's like where the intellectuals live. It's for him, he's a social climber. And I respect, I mean, I don't mean this disrespectful. I think he's the first generation that went to university. His parents didn't go to university. And also he has problems relating to a world where this isn't as important as it was to him. So he feels that he's not understood by the others, by his daughters, for example. And living in this neighborhood is one of the, I mean, he went through many failures. He lost his money, he invested money, he bought a big house, and he has a tenant, of course, it's all subplots. And he lost the money, so he lost everything. He lost his wife, he lost his money, and he lost his work. And then the two things left for him, the address, the place where he's living, and the fact that there's one daughter, and he wants, his desire now is to be a good father, to be the perfect father.
The daughter who gives the novel its title, Tirza. Well, first off, who's Tirza? And I don't mean this one. One that probably has an H on the end of it, who I assume is the character that this is named after.
Why the name Tirza?
Yeah.
I had first another name, but then I discovered in the Bible the name Tirza, and I like that name so much. It's in the Song of Songs. And I thought also the Song of Songs, there's a connection between the Song of Songs. And you call it the Song of Songs in English, no?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the relationship Hofmeister is having with Tirza. Because he's really, it's more than the average love a father is feeling for his daughter. It's like she is the reason why he's still alive.
Extreme joy, extreme pride.
Exactly. Yeah. And also he put all his ambitions, all he wanted to accomplish in life, that is something he wanted his daughter to accomplish, to do. He wanted his daughter to succeed where he failed. It's classic, of course, but it's what happens to him and his daughter.
Now, she gives the novel its title, and the dynamic, there's many dynamics in the novel, but the relationship he has with her does go from the beginning to the end of the book and takes him from Holland to Africa.
Yes.
In fact, talk a bit about that father-daughter connection and what it means in the context of all that you were saying before, of his life sort of crumbling around him.
Well, my first novel I wrote about parents from the perspective of a young man, of a boy. And in this novel I wanted to turn it around. I wanted to see the children from the perspective of the parents, from the father. Of course, a novel has many reasons why it comes into existence, but one of the things that gave me this idea was I have a godson, and the godson was born in New York. His father is Bolivian. He couldn't come because he didn't get a visa. And my godson really looks like a Bolivian man, a Bolivian young man. But in the Presbyterian hospital where his mother was lying, after 2 days, a nurse came to me and said, "Oh, can I talk to you?" I said, "Oh my God, something happened to my godson or to his mother." I said, "Yes, to his mother." And then she took my hand and said, "Oh, I feel so bad for you." And I didn't get it. So I asked a question and I said, "Oh, but what your wife did to you?" And then I realized that she thought that my wife had cheated on me, and of course it was. So the original version of this book is about something completely else. But it's about a father who mistaken, but people think that his son whatever. It went a completely different direction. But what this godson taught to me was how suddenly I felt responsible for this kid, although it's not my kid and he would leave with him. And I had even nightmares about what could happen to him. So I thought this so interesting that even if it's not my own kid, but just because he's in my surroundings and I go there every day to see his mother, it changed my whole state of mind, my being. So I thought I have to write something about a father. That was the beginning, basically, of this novel. It starts always with a small idea. Sometimes it's a sentence, sometimes it's a title, and in this case, you can say it was my godson.
I should know this, having done the exhaustive research I've done for this interview, but are you a father yourself?
No, I'm not.
Wow.
No, I'm not.
It's just, you
I'm
do
a son,
and,
but
you're a son, but not a father. I'm a son and a father. Reading the book, you nailed this guy. You understand the kind of paranoias that come from parenthood, the kind of overwhelming involvement you have in a younger life that you know is going to be leaving you. You've got that down pat. And how did you do that research?
Well, of course, I experienced my own parents and I observed them. How does a writer write about things he hasn't experienced himself? I think often a novelist or an author is also an outsider. And I don't mean an outsider negative. An outsider is just somebody who is observing other people, who's able to observe other people. When you go to a party and you talk yourself all the time, you are less able to observe other people than when you're standing in a corner and you see how other people talk. Mm-hmm. And for one reason or the other, I always felt very, very happy and very natural being a bit the outsider, being observing other people. And I think this is, I observed also my own parents, and I observed other parents. So I think part of being an author, being a novelist, is this ability to, sometimes I call it spying, but that may sound too negative. That may sound that you're preying on other people, but just you look at other people, you see them, and you learn from them. And also it started when I was a teenager, that I really had the feeling, I don't know how I should live my life. I don't know how, I want to know how other people did it. I really wanted to know, and I think that's one of the reasons I started writing.
You got in trouble as a teenager, sorry. You were kicked out of high school.
As a teenager, I wanted to be an actor. I think that was maybe because I thought that as an actor, it's easier on stage, it's easier to live or whatever. So I decided to leave high school. Also because my parents had high expectations. They wanted me to become a scientist and some things like that. You know, really like, not a normal scientist, but a scientist who wins the Nobel, something like that.
Well, there's literature, you know. You can win for literature, too.
And I wanted to be an actor. So to make the point, to make it clear to both my parents, my father was still alive at that moment, that I didn't want to become a scientist. I want to become an actor. I decided not to go to school anymore, and I left high school. And then I tried to be an actor, and I failed completely. First of all, no theater school accepted me as an actor. As a student, and then I tried to work as an actor without theater school, and I did all kinds of humiliating jobs. And after 2 years, I discovered that it was just not for me, and I started working for a company that published phone books.
Published phone books?
Phone books, a kind of yellow pages. I'm not sure if they still exist, but that's a kind of yellow pages. And I was...
Do phones still exist?
Yeah, well, I remember the manager, he told me when I had the interview, I said to him, well, I left high school, I feel like an actor, and there's not much I'm not capable of many things. He said, oh, that doesn't matter. Nobody is capable of many things. I myself am a poet, and I'm 50 years old, and I'm making phone books, so join the club. Wow. And he was also the one who fired me after 3 years. He said, don't go the same path as I went. I came in into this company when I was your age. I'm still here and I'm unhappy. I think you should go into another direction. So you should leave us.
Didn't you found your own publishing company then?
That's after that. After I was
That's
forced to
That's not a
to
different
leave,
direction.
I founded my own. I thought what I always... My parents were particular. First of all, quite old parents. Everybody thought that my father was my grandfather. My father was born in 1912. And my mother was born in 1927. But my parents, they were both from Germany, German Jews, and I felt they felt very much German. Grew up religious, but my father was listening to German radio, reading German newspapers, and he hated television. He was very much against television. So I was not allowed other people, so there was no television in my parental home, but I could go to the movies, and I could buy all the books I wanted. That was the entertainment that was allowed. So I thought, since I grew up with reading, because reading and going to the movies, there was no other entertainment, I thought I will start my own publishing house, because it's something that came very natural. And also, I had been to the Frankfurt Book Fair. That's a big book fair, the biggest book fair in the world, and I was impressed by everything that was going on there. So basically, at that moment, I was walking around there, I said, okay, that's what I'm going to do now. And I published 5 books, and then, of course, the books did get good reviews. They were all translations from German and Polish, but they didn't sell. So I was bankrupt.
So you became, you took the only possible course, someone bankrupt, you started writing yourself. Mm. We all know that writers are like...
Almost.
Overwhelmingly rich.
In my in the garage of my mother, my father had passed away at the time, there were hundreds, no, thousands of books that were not sellable, that I couldn't sell. And I thought maybe they're worth some money still. So I went back to the Frankfurt Book Fair and I tried to sell the remainders of my publishing house to a Dutch publisher. And there was almost no publisher who wanted to talk to me except for one, and he took me out for dinner. And we had lots of vodka and lots of bad Chinese food. And at the end of the evening, he said, forget about this publishing house. I'm not going to buy your publishing house. These books will never, they just get, burn them. But I think you're an interesting guy. You should write a novel.
And that's Blue Mondays, your first
that
novel.
That became Blue Mondays. Yeah.
Which is sort of about the underside of Amsterdam.
Yes and no. Yes, it's about a young man who leaves high school. His father passes away. He doesn't know what to do with his life, and he decides to become a gigolo, but he's not able to find clients.
I'm beginning to notice some running themes.
What are the running? The failure. I think. But I do think that, to be honest, it's a famous Dutch author who passed away, Wave Hermans, once said, "Success is boring." And I do think in a novel, but also outside, success is just not very interesting. I find failure much more interesting and appealing than success.
Now, but that Blue Mondays was a success. It won the first novel award in Holland.
It was a critical success and a commercial success, and especially the last thing I had not expected to happen, because my publisher at that time had warned me. He said, "When from a debut novel, we may sell 2,000 copies. If it's good, 3,000. Don't expect more. 3,000 is already really good, and it sold almost 100,000, even more than 100,000 copies.
Wow.
So this really changed a bit of my life. Also because after suddenly there were no money problems, I could pay my debts, and I could start writing for magazines and newspapers.
And it was published not only in Dutch,
no,
in Holland.
Then it was sold to many others. Yeah, I think we are now 14 or 15 languages that's been translated into. Yeah.
And that would have also opened up journalistic options for you.
Exactly.
Because
then,
you work
then,
as a journalist.
Then that's when I started working first as a columnist, and then when I moved to New York, a big Dutch newspaper asked me to write a letter from New York every 2 weeks. So in a way, as the moment May 2nd, 1994, Blue Mondays came out, and since that day, I've been making a living as an author. I'm very fortunate.
Arnon Grunberg, Dutch author of about a dozen novels, many of which have been translated into English, including Blue Mondays, Tirza, and The Jewish Messiah. I spoke with him recently as part of the Blue Metropolis Métropole Bleue Literary Festival in Montreal. I'm Paul Kennedy, and you're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1. Back now to my onstage conversation with Arnon Grunberg. I'm going to ask the second question now,
okay. But
it will continue the conversation, okay. I think, and excuse my mangled Dutch. Who is Mark van der Jacht?
No, that's very good. Mark van der Jacht. This is my pseudonym. My nom de plume, my pseudonym. After my second novel came out in 97, when your book is a success, suddenly, I was on television in the Netherlands a few times, people had an idea about who I was. And I had a feeling that this idea, my public persona, was standing in between the reader and my books. And I wanted to focus more on the text and less on the author. And I thought the best thing to do this is to write a book under pseudonym. Nobody should know that it's me. And then people really could see my text with a different eye. At least that was what I was hoping for. And I came up with this persona, Mike van der Jacht, who's Viennese. His father is Dutch, his mother is Austrian. He is a failed philosophy student. And the book basically is about a young man who is, it's called The Story of My Boldness, who is convinced that he has the smallest penis in the world and he wants to do something about it.
Doesn't one doctor actually say to him, "It's too small, I can't operate," or something like that? Spoiler alert, sorry.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. But the funny thing is that and then the problem started, because the book came out and all went well. The critics, they saw references to other Austrian authors, and nobody thought it was me. There was no connection. But then this book won the award for the best first novel. I had won already in 1994.
And you can't write the best first novel twice.
Right, exactly. And then journalists were trying to contact Mike van der Jacht. And then that was the moment that I started to make mistakes. For example, I was sending emails. I was giving interviews via email. I said, well, Mike van der Jacht is very shy. But I didn't know at that time that you can see, if you're a bit clever, where the email comes from. You can discover that it's not sent from Vienna, but somewhere from the northeastern part of the U.S. So since there are not too many authors living in the U.S., people thought it's me, and there were also things about style. So then there was a whole thing in the media. And I wrote another novel under that name, and then in 2005 I gave up and I declared that Mike van der Jacht died. And now they republished the book under my own name in the Netherlands.
I think we can segue into the next sort of novel that made a big splash, The Jewish Messiah, which comes soon after that, right? Or see, it's weird because the novels are published first in Dutch and then translated into English, and they come out in weird orders.
In weird orders and for many reasons. And for example, Tirzak came out in the Netherlands in 2006, and it came out in the US 2013, so there's 7 years in between. The Jewish Messiah came out in 2004. 2004? Yes, 2004. Yeah, what was your question?
Well, the question is that you've killed the person that you say was your writer for a while. You come back to being yourself. You write this novel, which got you into some trouble, I noticed, from reading some of the critical reactions to it, because it's a pretty swashbucklingly funny sort of play on everything, but religion being at the heart of it in some ways.
And the Holocaust
being hard. Yeah, it's dangerous turf. Now, the Holocaust is part of it. I don't want to fall into the trap of saying some of my best friends are Jews or whatever that is, but you know, your mother was a survivor.
My mother was a camp survivor. My father survived the war when it was in hiding. So for me, the war was kind of close. For example, my mother, when she was angry with her husband or with her kids, she always used to say, "I had it better in Auschwitz than with you." And my father, when he was angry, and when I came in too loud, he said, "Oh, he comes in like the Gestapo again." Wow. So there were always references to the war, but always the references were that the children, especially me, I was like a Nazi. Or my mother also used to say the Nazis were worse, but what you do to me is worse than them. So I remember when I was 8 or 9 years old, I was convinced that I was a Nazi. You know,
what happened in the hospital? The nurse came up again and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry about your son." But the book got you in trouble.
But the book is, and then of course the book is about. I had quite a religious upbringing. I went to synagogue every Saturday, and I remember also in the synagogue we had a man from Austria who wanted to become Jewish, and he told us that his father was a high-ranking Nazi officer, and it was one of the reasons that he wanted to become Jewish, because he wanted to do something for the Jews. He wanted to give something back, and he was really.
This happens to the protagonist.
He was nuts. I was making fun of him. I couldn't see how heartbreaking this was. And also, he committed suicide after a while. But this idea stayed in my head that the second generation of the war criminals, they suffer sometimes even more than the second generation of the victims. Also because, of course, they cannot. How do they? Naturally, you identify with your parents, but they cannot, or they should not, or they. It's very hard for them. And this stayed in my mind. And another thing that propelled this book, my sister, not that it's autobiographical, but my sister, she moved to Israel and she's a settler. She's a really hardcore right-wing settler. First she lived in Gaza, now on the West Bank. And I've been to the settlements many times. And so I know this world, I think I know this world quite well. I know this part of of Israel quite well. And I remember I was on a plane to Georgia, not Georgia, US, but Georgia in Europe. And I was sitting next to an English guy, and he was, for one reason or the other, he went on about Israel, the Middle East, and then he said, well, you know, he was not talking about Israelis anymore, he was talking about Jews. He said, you know, basically, what I did to the Jews was awful, but you know, you see what's happening there, the Jews just are like the Nazis. Now, I think these days it's a very common comparison, but still I was a bit shocked and I felt uncomfortable, and I'm a coward. I didn't dare to say, hey, I'm Jewish myself. So I was just eating there my plain food and nodding, and I didn't want, but I thought this is so interesting that apparently people feel free to compare the Jews to the Nazis as if it's the same. And all these ideas propelled me to write a book about, the basic idea was about the son of the grandson of a Nazi who is convinced that he should become Jewish in order to comfort the Jews for what happened to him. And of course, there's also, I experienced, especially in Germany, where I've done many readings, that there's a thin line, some people, between philo-Semitism, being in love with Jews for one reason or the other, and anti-Semitism. Because it's very easy that it turns around. And this was one of the main ideas for this novel.
It's one thing for the son or daughter of a high-level ranking Nazi to convert to Judaism.
it's another thing for that person ultimately to move to Israel and become elected as leader. And
well, of course, many things. First of all, he's living in Basel, and he falls in love with the son of a rabbi, of the really Hasidic rabbi. And as a kid, I was sent to Mishnah school, to the Mishnah, what's the Mishnah like? Every year there was like a big congress where all the kids went to in Switzerland, or it was France, but often in Switzerland. So also there I knew this part of the Jewish world quite well. And my experience with really the ultra-Orthodox Jews in the Netherlands also that on the one hand they were very ultra-Orthodox, but on the other hand, I never heard my first basically experience with really dirty jokes or pornographic jokes was all in the Mishnah school. My sexual education, I didn't learn much Mishnah, but my sexual education started in the Mishnah school. I think maybe because these kids were so oppressed, but really they didn't know. And also that all the at that time were the dirty magazines. They knew how to buy them or they had them. So it was an interesting time for me. So I thought that this...
non-interesting time?
Yeah, I had this imagination that this grandson of a Nazi officer who really has these ideas about how the Jews are. He meets this son of a rabbi who's completely different from what he expects the Jews to be. And then together and he speaks also Yiddish, like many of the Hasidic Jews in Switzerland do. And then he has the idea that they should translate Mein Kampf into Yiddish. That's how the friendship starts. What I didn't know is that, and this is very ironic, that there is a Yiddish translation of Mein Kampf. Somebody translated it into Yiddish.
When?
Shortly after the war.
So fiction runs fairly close to fact.
often it does. Yes.
Now, I alluded to the reaction to the book, and I'm curious to know, were there some extreme responses, both critically and or personally?
No, thank God not. The only thing is my German publisher refused to publish the books for many years. It just came out in Germany because he didn't want to publish it in Germany. He was afraid of reactions that were... he thought that people would not take it well or would misinterpret it. But no, of course, there were some... When the book came out in the Netherlands, there were some people who were angry, but not... I think people took it well. They took it... When something is called a novel, you can do many things. You know, it's like this piece of the world where you have liberties that you would not have elsewhere. So, and my mother, my sister stopped reading my books. My mother was much angrier about my first book.
Your sister, this is the one who's in Israel.
I have only one sister who's a settler. She doesn't.
So she won't read these.
No. And my mother, she didn't take it. She kind of. I'm not sure if she liked it, but she was very angry about the first book, Blue Mondays, because she thought that she was in the book. She could recognize somebody that was close to her. And she was very angry about that.
But I hate
she
to wasn't. Say who.
Guess who? I think the reactions weren't... We're okay.
Now you mentioned that you can do things in a novel that you can't do when you're writing journalism, which seems like an obvious segue for me to talk about a book you wrote, which I couldn't get in book form, but I actually could read online on your website, which, or at least parts of it I could read on. I don't know if I got the whole thing. The book's called Among Soldiers. It was published in 2006, and I want to talk about it here because what you did was that you went to Afghanistan and sort of embedded yourself within the Dutch troops who were serving there. Canada has a somewhat similar experience in Afghanistan.
I know. That was my first... the first time I went into a Tim Hortons...
Was in Kabul?
Was in Kandahar Airfield. In New York, there's no Tim Hortons, but there I discovered Tim Hortons. So that was I was not embedded with the Canadians, but of course in Kandahar, it's like the Canadians, they were all over there. They had their own part. It was next to the Dutch. They were, No, I started doing, I was, my first book came out, as we discussed, in 1994, and after a while, I was a bit tired of being part of the literary world and writing my books and writing my columns about my trips and my life and going to a conference and going back to my... I thought there's a whole world outside this world where I don't know anything about it. And I talked to my editor-in-chief at a Dutch newspaper and I told... It was just the Dutch were just going into Afghanistan and I said, I have the feeling I have to go there. I want to go to this. I want to see... I want to write about something else than just about books and fiction and literature. I said, oh, no, you can't do it. You're not a war journalist and we can't cover you. But then I said, I will do it myself and you just publish the article. So I wrote a letter to the Ministry of Defense and I asked them to if I could be embedded. And after a few weeks, they allowed me to go there. And then I decided that was a very important experience for me, and I decided to do more journalistic pieces. And I thought also the working on a journalistic piece and writing a novel is a very nice combination.
At the same time?
Not at the same time, but for a while doing a journalistic piece and then you go back to the novel.
Alternate back and forth.
Exactly.
I want to know what happened to you in Afghanistan. I mean, I'm a journalist. I should be more prone to be wanting to go to war zones. I'm allergic to bullets, though, and so I only just met you. I don't know you well, but you don't seem like the kind of guy who would really get off on guns and tanks. And
totally not. I had all kind of prejudices against the army. Also, when I was 18, there was still draft in the Netherlands. And because I had left high school, I was sent to a psychiatrist because my parents thought that somebody who doesn't want to go to university is mad. Maybe he is. But this psychiatrist, he told me that I should not go to the army, and he said, I will write a letter for you to the Ministry of Defense, but you are not allowed to see what's in the letter. So he sent a letter, and after 3 weeks, I got a telegram saying that the Royal Kingdom of the Netherlands would not use me as a soldier, not even in times of war. And I was very happy about this letter. So I had all kinds of prejudices against the soldiers and against the military, but the moment I was embedded, these prejudices fell apart because there's so many different characters you'll find in the army. And also, this may sound strange, but the first time, there were rocket attacks at that time coming into Kandahar airfield almost every night. And the first night I experienced this rocket attack gave me a feeling of intense happiness because I survived it. They told me, when you hear the rockets, you are going to be fine because of the sound. The sound is not...
So if you don't hear it, you're not going
to be fine.
If you
don't hear it, you're not. But if you hear it, it's fine because it's already over you. So I was... And of course, we had to go to a bunker, but there was no time to go to a bunker. So I was laying on my bed. And I had this feeling of really intense, and not intense happiness. A feeling of in being alive that I had not had before.
I can understand the sense of being alive because you're experiencing life really on the edge there. But the happiness part concerns me somewhat.
The feeling, because you're so conscious that your life was at risk and that you're still alive, that gave me at least enormous amount of happiness. And when I talk to soldiers there, you have basically two reactions. Some really don't want, they really hate the war zone, and others they become addicted.
Do you think you could become addicted?
I've been back many times, but I don't want to be addicted. And also the first time I was in a war zone, it's the second or third time you go back, it's never the same. It's not as intense as the first time. I've been to Iraq, I was embedded with US soldiers a few times. No. But to give an example, I was also embedded with chambermaids because the collection is called, the official title, the Dutch title is called Soldiers and Chambermaids. And I worked as a chambermaid or a chamber boy in a hotel in Bavaria where I cleaned rooms for 4 weeks.
That's really frontline, actually.
That's different. But there I also, because I had a sense of, tremendous sense of happiness by just focusing on working with my colleagues and doing this kind of work for a while. I think it's being part, if I can explain, you're part of a community and you know that you can get out. That is a very nice sense. And of course, the war zone is a bit different, but even there, I felt I was very close to my co-worker, and we had something, not an affair, but it was an older Turkish lady, but it was a kind of friendship going on, and we had the same goal we were making. Of course, I learned so many things. For example, when they didn't change the sheets after a guest left when he had stayed for less than 3 days. So we just put away some pubic hair, and
I'll check when I go upstairs.
Yes.
Here.
the manager, that was like a family-run hotel, she told me, it doesn't have to be clean, it has to look clean.
Wow. You're talking about happiness, and we'll open for questions from the floor in a moment. I just want to say that from reading you and now from meeting you, you seem like somebody who's almost innately happy.
Oh, it can be very sad also, but not when I talk to you.
Flattery will get you nowhere.
No, but it's not. Listen, I don't believe that writing should be suffering. There's already enough suffering. So sometimes it gives me pleasure, and sometimes less. But it's not that I'm happy. that it's a state of happiness. I think you can only be happy when you know what it's to be unhappy. We don't allow ourselves to be unhappy. Being unhappy is something that should be solved. We should take medicine. I think you can be unhappy for a week or two. It's nothing wrong with that. Melancholy, is a Swiss friend once told me, is the depression that says yes to life. I find it's a very nice definition. So often I'm very melancholic, or I know the experience of melancholy. And I think that's an important part of life. You cannot go through life while being happy all the time. It's unrealistic to think you can.
I think a lot of writers are melancholic, actually.
I think all intelligent people are melancholic. And not to say that if you're too happy, you're stupid. That's not what I say. But I think if you see through certain things, I think the only possible reaction is melancholy.
On that, I think we should open for questions from the floor.
Well, I have just a couple of questions, but more in the nature of comments. You, Paul, had said that you're allergic to bullets. I wanted to know where you developed the antibodies.
Some people have it. It's a natural thing, I think, but I don't.
Another kind of linguistic oversight, maybe, was when our speaker said, a famous Dutch author said success is boring. There's a delicious irony in that, if you think about it. A famous Dutch author.
No,
and my question is actually quite serious. I'm curious to know whether my perception is a misperception or accurate in that many Dutch people I've talked with have a certain kind of self-effacing quality, and I wonder whether you see yourself in that way in some sense.
I'm not sure if it's typical Dutch. And there is, thank you for pointing out, by the way, that there is an irony in the famous Dutch author who's, but I would say this, I was talking about W.F. Hermans, by the way, and I really think this man who passed away didn't perceive himself as a big success, although he was one of the most famous authors in the Netherlands, for many reasons, but that's not for this moment. No, I think self-effacing, this self-irony or this the love for the understatement is not only cannot only be found in the Netherlands, but in many other places and many other cultures. To me, I would say it's a matter of civilization. Sounds maybe too harsh, but you don't want to. This it's very boring to sell yourself or to speak highly of yourself. I think we are forced to do it all the time, and maybe I did it today, then I apologize. But I think it's just not very interesting. It's not a dialogue. The moment you start to, you know, a dialogue starts when, I think irony is also, it's not only a mechanism of self-defense, that's the worst, or the not very interesting irony. Irony is the possibility of a dialogue. It's an invitation to see that the other person is not secure and is in the most basic sense human.
Other questions? I have a question that comes from the web research I did, I guess, and it comes from your website, which again I had a lot of fun going through. And maybe this is a interesting thing in the context of what you and I have just been doing. You have an interview up there with Günter Grass. I don't speak German. I watched the whole thing. I had no idea what you were asking him, even, but whether you were enjoying being with him, whether he was enjoying being with you. Tell me about that interview with Günter Grass.
Yeah, that is a very Günter Grass. The interview happened in January. I went to his home in Hamburg. He just returned from the hospital. And one of the reasons I did the interview was there was a big, you may have heard about it, a big fuss, especially in Germany, about some poems he wrote about Israel. And I was especially interested because it's in my point of view, it was very much related to the Jewish Messiah, about the question whether Israel was a threat to world peace or not. And of course, coming from him, it made it even more...
Because there was the ambiguity about his
own
childhood.
Of course. So I had a discussion about his past, but also I think as an interviewer, I was not there I didn't want to be too polemical. I just want to ask questions, and I want to give him an opportunity to explain himself about why he had written these poems, and also about his memoirs, an excellent memoir, Peeling the Onion, which I liked very much. And I've always been very interested in, especially in his earlier work. I think that's still terrific. So we had a conversation about his wartime experience, about his political engagement, because he was always very politically engaged in Germany. He was a member of the Social Democratic Party. He helped them basically with a few elections. He was really campaigning for them. And I think he made a few interesting remarks about his position. And do you want me to go further?
Well, I'm happy to hear that you had fun, because it did look like, I mean, you looked a little nervous, and I'm just thinking.
I was a bit nervous, also because I didn't know what to expect, and there were people around you didn't see on screen, but I felt there was a bit of pressure going on. But then,
well, microphones actually start that pressure from the beginning. I mean, yeah. they change the nature of the conversation, because, you know, it's not really a quote natural conversation, no. Because we're using electronic devices to
exactly. But no, I thought that the interview went well, because I think one of the tasks of the interview is to give the other person the opportunity to speak as openly as possible. And I think that he felt the liberty that he could talk and say the things he wanted to say. And I hope, and I think he did, he said some things he had not said before.
Which are?
He really explained why he wrote, I think, why he's so critical and obsessed with Israel. And this comes... he thinks that as a German, he has a special responsibility not only towards the Jewish people, but also the Palestinian people. Hmm. And he is less forgiving when it... I think it's for him hard to see that a Jew sometimes is not a victim. It's not a victim. So that a Jew can be... totally human and can do awful things too. Hmm. I remember being in Germany, getting the question, can a Jew be a fascist? I said, of course, a Jew can be anything. Why not? Why would we expect a Jew not to be able to be a Nazi? There was in New York a famous Jewish anti-Semite who was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. As a movie was made about it, to give an example. Maybe we're getting too serious now.
Okay, let's go for another question then. Okay.
Would you say that there is some kind of Jewish humor in your work? And if so, how would you qualify it or define it?
Yeah, first there was the question about the Dutch understatement about the Jewish humor. Yeah. Humor is humor, and I think humor is I think all humor is in a way tragic. It's not only a characteristic of the Jewish humor. So of course I'm very hesitant about. I think humor is humor, and then we don't Jewish humor or not. This is not a direction I'd like to go. So I don't perceive it myself as Jewish humor. I perceive it as humor, and I think humor is just part of the whole tradition of the novel. Milan Kundera pointed out, and that's really in his essays, he has written great essays about the novel, that in his point of view, the novel started with Don Quixote, with Cervantes, and he said the humor is a typical, there's no great novel without humor, without irony, and I wholeheartedly agree. So I would never describe it as Jewish humor. Although, good humor is good humor. And that can be, I mean, and that the foundation of it is, I think, is the same whether you go to Kurdistan or to... And you have there the Kurdish humor or Jewish humor. So I wouldn't, it's not a label I would put on my humor.
On Ideas, you've been listening to The Author as Fiction, a conversation with Dutch novelist and journalist Arnon Grunberg. My thanks to the friendly folks at the Blue Metropolis Metropole Bleu Literary Festival in Montreal, and specific thanks to Tanya Birkbeck and everybody at CBC Blue. If you'd like to listen to this conversation again, or in fact to any other Ideas show, please go to our website at cbc.ca/ideas. The executive producer of Ideas is Pam Bertrand. I'm Paul Kennedy. The hourly news is next on CBC Radio 1.